Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to this town hall. It's very nice to see so many folks here that we don't usually see. We probably actually have a quorum for once, so that's great. It's also great to have a lot of students here. Always great to see that the Faculty of Medicine continues to engender enormous interest in our community. So, as you know, the focus of this this town hall will be admissions. We've known for some time that there is an issue in terms of communication about admissions. There's a lot of concern in the community, and there is a lot of discussion inside the faculty. We actually delayed holding this town hall until after the elections. We had thought of doing it earlier, but for reasons that are obvious, we thought that that would be even more fraught than it is right now. The goal here of today's town hall is to provide a forum for discussion, primarily for the faculty members, but also this is an open meeting. There are some public members here, and they're very welcome. And we have students here, as I mentioned. We've known for some time, as I said earlier, that there's an issue with admissions. Not because of that, but as part of our addressing the issue of admissions, we did do an external review, and we're confident that we're doing things the right way. That being said, we are here primarily today to listen. The schedule includes some presentations, followed by a long hour of time to take questions and suggestions from the audience. Just before beginning, I wanted to make a couple of points in the context of the media coverage, and this is specifically for the students who are present. Some of the comments that have been in the media are a little bit, in my view, are regrettable. I sent a message to the students yesterday to underscore how impressed I am by the engagement of the students, by their contribution to medical education. I really am enormously proud of the students at this school, actually all our schools, but today we're talking about the School of Medicine. I just want to say on behalf of the faculty to the students that remember that this is your school, you got here on your merit, and you're an integral part of the faculty, each and every one of you, okay, notwithstanding what some people have implied in the media. With that being said, I'll figure out how the slides work. There we go. So the agenda. So as you know, I gave you a welcome and context for discussion. We're going to hear from Dr. Robert Primavesi, who is the Associate Dean for Undergraduate Medical Education, for 10 minutes, followed by Salim Razak, who is the Director of Admissions, Equity, and Diversity, followed by a dynamic trio of Aaron Silberman, Sophie Vincent, and Nebras Worsi, who will talk about the students' experience. And then, as you can see, I get the privilege of moderating a brief one-hour open forum where anything... The framework that you should keep in mind before Rob gives his presentation is the context in which we have to do admissions. And I think this is very important to say. First of all, we have to be true to the faculty's mission of training the best physicians that we can for society. We have to be true to the university's mission of being committed to excellence. We also have to be, in our admissions policy, mindful of the requirements of accreditation for medical schools in North America. As you know, right to this point, our accreditation criteria are the same as those of the United States. And that actually is pertinent to what we're saying, as you're going to hear. And finally, we have to make sure that in order to be an excellent school, it has to be very competitive to get into our school, because if it isn't competitive, we won't be able to guarantee that our graduates are the very best graduates they can be. And I can assure you, it's very competitive, and our graduates are outstanding. And so with that, over to you, Rob.
Thank you, David, and good afternoon. So what I'm going to do over the next few minutes is just review some of the principles behind the new undergraduate medical curriculum and try to relate to how it applies to the admissions and selection process. So my objectives are we'll review the framework, we'll go over some of the hot topics in medical education as they exist on a national level, and we'll talk a little bit about measuring outcomes. So my disclosure is that I am the Associate Dean for Undergraduate Medical Education, so therefore I'm invested in the new curriculum, and I'm invested in the success of the students, so I do approach this from a biased point of view. So the idea of curricular renewal is something that started at McGill in 2008 with a strategic planning called Think Dangerously, and undergraduate medical education was one of the things that was looked at, but also something that was happening nationally across Canada through the Association of Faculty of Medicine of Canada in the Future Medical Education in Canada document for undergrad. And they both actually came out in 2010. And this is the and the FMEC document is really what all medical schools are using to guide their curricular renewal as it's being done across the country. The Think Dangerously document, the vision was to be for McGill to be recognized as Canada's foremost medical undergraduate program, preparing future generations of graduates to take their place as leading medical practitioners, educators, and researchers, and was based on the values of physicianship, addressing the needs of society, adaptability in terms of the educational program, and adaptability of the learners to integrate new information as it becomes available, and scholarship. The strategic plan came up with eight recommendations in the direction of medical education, that we need to address the needs of society, we need to ensure educational excellence, that our teachers should have McGill appointments so that they fit within the McGill family and receive the support that they need. We need to promote lifelong learning. We need to provide an early clinical exposure to provide relevance of the medical education program to our students. We need to counter the hidden curriculum, so the messages that the students get in class are the same messages that they get when they're in the hospitals and in the community. We have to have a centrally managed curriculum so that we know what we're teaching, and it's not just delegated to various disciplines. And we have to learn in an interprofessional teamwork framework, because that's a way that medicine is practiced. It also defined the attributes of a McGill graduate. So we want them to have clinical expertise, a stage appropriate. We want them to show the healing and professionalism as part of physicianship. They need to have effective communication skills. They need to work as part of the team. They have to have critical thinking and decision making. They have to be adaptable. They have to understand the healthcare system, and they have to be able to do independent work and scholarship. And if you look at what the recommendations that came out of the Future Medical Education in Canada document, it's very, very similar to what came up at McGill. So two parallel processes, and I won't read all of this in the interest of time, but you can certainly glance through this. So this is really the framework for curricular renewal. The AFMC also had an FMEC postgrad residency, yeah, so for residency, for postgrad. So, and they came up with 10 recommendations, and one of the recommendations had to do with transitions in terms of creating smooth transitions throughout all phases of medical education, from undergrad through postgrad into clinical practice. And this is certainly one of the main focuses of energy now at AFMC. So the Canadian Conference on Medical Education happens once a year. It was in Ottawa last week. And this brings back together all the leadership in medical education across Canada. So all the undergraduate deans meet, the deans meet, the postgrad deans meet, faculty development meets, student affairs meets, and there's a whole bunch of great educational research that is presented, including from our Center for Medical Education here at McGill. So these are some of the hot topics that were discussed in terms of undergraduate medicine. So first of all, it's all about transition. So that fifth recommendation from the FMEC postgrad document. How do we create smooth transitions? And three out of the 10 postgrad recommendations have funding behind it. Transitions is one of them. And we discussed everything from what should be in a dean's letter to how do we, what they're trying to do is how do we hand over a student to a residency program so that they can continue their learning. This ties in very much to competency-based education or curriculum. As you may know, postgraduate training is moving towards a competency-based curriculum where residents will be judged on their competencies and achieving competencies over time. And it no longer needs to be a time-dependent process. I think that's going to be much more difficult to do in medical school. But I think we're going to need to move in terms of not just measuring performance at the end of a period of time, but to actually measure competencies throughout medical school. And the thought is that each medical student would have a portfolio where they log their patient encounters and their learning according to competencies, and that portfolio will follow the students into postgraduate training, and then will follow the resident into medical practice and will be used for continual professional education for the physicians in practice. A lot of talk about human health resource planning. There are many residents who are worried about finding jobs at the end of their medical training. Certainly medical students feel the same way. Quebec is ahead of the game. Quebec does a quite intricate calculation on the manpower requirements for different specialties using the average age of the practitioners, the age of retirement, the age of the population, et cetera, et cetera. The rest of Canada is quite behind that. So now the AFMC is actually creating a task force to try to come up with some human resource planning for the rest of Canada. CARMS was a topic of discussion. McGill did very well in CARMS this year. We had three students that did not match, but that was not the experience in the rest of Canada. There was about just over 50 students who did not match across Canada. And for the first time, there's talk about, well, maybe graduating from medical school is not a guarantee of a residency training position. Yes. All right, and I don't think that's actually the approach. But what is clear is that that family medicine is no longer a backup to another specialty. Family medicine is becoming very competitive. McGill has been filling all its family medicine spots for the last few years, and as much as Beth Cummings told me I was an individualist. So I very much promote students achieving their individual goals, but as Quebec's human health resource planning moves to 2017, having 55% of the postgraduate training positions in family medicine and 45% in other specialties, that if we don't upfront at the admissions process tell students that in terms of a career in Quebec, 55% of you should be thinking about practicing family medicine, we're going to have a gap. So for the last couple of years, McGill graduates have been just over 30% placing into family medicine. This year we've dropped down under 30%. So if students can find positions at McGill, they're going to go to other universities in Quebec or outside of Quebec. And so we have to think about preparing their students right from the very beginning. And we'll see what the impact of the new curriculum, the longitudinal family medicine experience that has placed all first-year students twice a month in a community family medicine practice, and see what some positive role modeling may have in the 2017 match. And much like FMEC has looked at undergraduate education and postgraduate education, FMEC has started a task force on admissions. So looking at admissions across Canada, and if I had to summarize that into a phrase, I think the major area of discussion was around how do we select for excellence but remove unnecessary barriers to the admissions process. And so there was a group of people from a lot of different backgrounds that met, and some of those recommendations are going to be written up and acted upon in the future. So if I had to summarize what all this means for in terms of new curriculum and the hot topics in undergraduate medicine in terms of admissions, I would say it's all about alignment. McGill is a medical school, and when we're thinking about admissions, we need to be aligned with what's happening nationally. We have to be aligned with the mission of the university and the Faculty of Medicine around education, research, and service. We have to meet accreditation standards, and I think Salim's going to talk a little bit about more of that. So they're up there for these are two of the standards that have to that deal with diversity of the students and of our faculty and staff. We need to look at the prerequisites so that the students are well prepared to succeed in the new curriculum. We cannot reteach everything that needs to be taught, so it's important that students come prepared. So Terry Haber and the Basic Science Committee have prepared a list of topics that every student should know before they come into medicine. That's now posted on the, it will be posted on the admissions website. And due to student initiative, there will actually be a study pack on our learning management system. So once students are admitted, they'll actually be able to look at some material and read in areas where they think they may need to brush up before they start medical school. We've talked about competency-based curriculum. I think we need to have competency-based assessments for admission, and the mini medical interviews are one such example. And ultimately, we need to measure outcomes. How do we measure success of our program? That was in the Gazette this weekend. So one way we measure success is to see how our students succeed within the program. That means examinations. So the examinations are as much a measure of student learning as it is of our success as faculty in teaching the students. And we've been very rigorous in examining the actual psychometrics of the exams to make sure that they're fair and they actually measure what we intend to measure. And I think that's about all I have to say. I'm going to turn it over to Salim.
So my goal this afternoon is to really give you the nuts and bolts of the admissions process. Rob used the word alignment, and I think that our process tries very hard to be aligned to the curriculum that we send students to, so that hopefully we'll be able to show you that as well. So as a disclosure, I'm the Assistant Dean of Admissions, Equity, and Diversity. I'm invested in the process as well, as Rob said, and that is what you should know. In terms of overview, I think the most important thing for you to know is that our number one goal is to admit excellent students who will graduate to become the best doctors. This is actually reflected throughout the accreditation requirements. Is really rooted in having a competitive process. Our aim is to ensure that all students from different backgrounds are welcome to apply. So Rob talked about the sort of the barriers issue. So we want to invite as many persons to the table as possible in our merit-based competition. All are assessed on a level playing field. There are no internal quotas, and we attempt to use the best practices as we select. Whoops. Rob alluded to some of the accreditation standards. I'm going to give you four of them, and just so that you know what we have to operate under when we're designing our admissions processes. So the first one is IS-16. IS stands for Institutional Standard, I believe. Institutional Settings. So it's the 16th one of the institutional settings. So an institution that offers medical education programs, a medical education program, must have policies and practices to achieve appropriate diversity among its students, faculty, staff, and other members of its academic community, and must engage in ongoing systematic and focused efforts to attract and retain students, faculty, and staff, and others from demographically diverse backgrounds. There's three more. I'll read them through, and then we'll get to the nuts and bolts of the admissions process. Two relevant ones for admissions, MS5, so medical students, 5. A medical education program must have a sufficiently large pool of applicants who possess national-level qualifications to fill its entering class. I will show you some data, or I can explain some data about that afterwards. Then there's MS7. At a medical education program, the selection of individual medical students for admission must not be influenced by any political or financial factors. And finally, the last one, which is that a medical education program must develop programs or partnerships aimed at broadening diversity among qualified applicants for medical school admission. So some facts, because admissions has been in the news for several times from last August to now. Here are the facts. So 90% of the positions are reserved for residents of Quebec. Residents of Quebec are defined, and you can check our website. They are defined in, I think, 14 different ways, and is actually quite an inclusive definition. We have no quotas based on language, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, any of that. And our approach to diversity has been to widen the pool, to attract the best, to be part of the merit-based competition. Academic performance accounts for 70% of the first screen, and CV and personal narrative submissions account for 30% of the first screen. The admissions committee, the people who select, who are part of the selection process, are about 75% docs. The rest, a mixture of allied health professionals, students, and residents. It's been more competitive than ever. We had 2,817 applicants for 184 positions this year. In 2003, that number was in the 900s, to give you an idea. And that has resulted in an increase in academic standards, higher GPAs for entering students. We have guiding principles that we try to use in terms of all of the processes and policies of our office. So the first guiding principle is seeking excellence. The second guiding principle is inclusivity, so that our processes are welcoming to persons from varied backgrounds and life trajectories. So that's the idea of looking at the issue of barriers. We seek to be aligned with the curriculum to which we send students. So they must our selection criteria must correspond to the educational and program objectives of the medical curriculum. We seek to be fair, and that means that all applicants to our programs are treated in a just and respectful manner and transparent in that if you, from an applicant's perspective, if you apply to our programs, you know how your file will be treated and how you will be treated if you come to be interviewed. So in terms of seeking excellence, and I just organized it that way in terms of the different guiding principles, our goal is to graduate the best doctors. What are the standards that we use? We use academic strengths and personal characteristics. And the personal characteristics are the ones to become highly competent and caring physicians that we have identified in our curriculum to become highly competent and caring physicians. The selection tools that we use are an assessment of the academic record, a person's CV and personal narrative, which is a combined document, and multiple mini interviews. In terms of the selection process, there are two phases. The first phase is the pre-selection for invitation to interview. That is when we start with approximately 2,800 applications, and we offer 500 interviews. That is based 70% on the academic dossier, and we look there at a person's performance, their GPA, their corrected GPA, as well as the progression of difficulty of their courses, whether they've been in a professional program or not, or if they have some post-baccalaureate education in a master's or a PhD program. Those files are looked at by two admissions professionals, and for the non-academic part of the process, the looking at personal qualities, we look at the CV personal narrative, and that is reviewed by two raters. Two raters review completely a CV personal narrative per person. For applicants invited to interview, that is where 500 applicants become 184 offers this year. This year it's 184. And for there are two programs for many of you, two broad programs that many of you know. There's the MDCM program. Those are that is for Quebecers. That is for students who have a degree, and that they are entered directly into medicine. And then there's the Med-P program, which students enter into a year in the Faculty of Sciences and then come into medicine. We also have IMGs, an IMG program, a program for international medical graduates who are residents of Quebec. Who are admitted with advanced standing with some of the preclinical years of medicine given in advanced standing. And we do also have a program for non-traditional applicants, which I won't talk about I won't talk about those two very much here because I think that it's a lot of information is important to really know about the vast majority of our applicants who are MDCM applicants and MedP applicants. In terms of applicant categories, this gives you a breakdown of this year. So we had 2,817 applicants. The astute among you will notice that if you add up all of the numbers, it's off by six. That is because the Quebec First Nations and Inuit Faculties of Medicine program is supernumerary to the application process. So we had about 878 applicants from Quebec last year for the spots that we have. In terms of volume of applicants, I thought it would be good for you to see how things have changed from 2003 to 2013. 971 applicants for all programs in 2003. In 2008, it was approximately 1,400 applicants for all programs. In 2013, it's 2,831 applicants for all programs. And if you, across the country, this number has, everybody has experienced an increase in numbers across the country, usually in the order of a doubling. For us, it's been a tripling. And what that has done is it has brought us into the competitive range of sister schools. For instance, the University of Toronto gets about 3,500 applicants a year, or 3,100 applicants a year. And then McMaster University gets 3,500 applicants per year. I think it's really important in terms of seeking excellence that you understand that we really do try to look at outcomes, and for multiple mini interviews, we're able to show that they show a strong and statistically significant correlation with student performance in core clerkships, which fits with that is at McGill, with McGill's MMIs with performance in clerkship. For those of you that are familiar with statistics, the correlation coefficient is 0.523 with a significant p-value of 0.038, so under 0.05. And this is consistent with literature from McMaster University and other sites. In terms of inclusivity, we have a distributed decision-making process, which I'll show you in a second, in terms of governance. Our evaluator board is a diverse board. In terms of outreach activities, we do reach out we have pipeline programs that do reach out to underrepresented communities, and we've tried our best to address unnecessary barriers and have a fully bilingual process. There's a few more slides. I'll try and be done in about 2 minutes, but this slide I'll just take 1 second to tell you about. This is, I think, one of the coolest things about McGill University. This slide shows you the proportion of students who are multilingual in English and French, or trilingual even, as well as the unilingual group. We see that 66% of our students are bilingual, and a good chunk of our students are trilingual. It's an extremely and wonderfully diverse environment from a linguistic perspective that we are in. This is how we are organized, this is actually how we are organized. It's been updated a little bit. So we have a widening participation committee, the members of which look after the pipeline programs and the outreach, and those members are not involved at all in the admissions process. And then we have three committees that look at admissions: advisory committee on best practices, professionalism standards committee, and the multiple mini interview committee that sets the multiple mini interviews. We have this is a consultative process for us. We are building in a regular yearly consultative process in order to get efforts getting feedback of things that we need to refer to different committees. Alignment, we are aligned with mission and curriculum, our selection criteria are aligned with curriculum, and we try to be aligned with physicianship objectives. We have established protocols and processes for extenuating circumstances, for reconsideration, and one important thing for you to know is that there is no discretion whatsoever in final outcomes. You get a mark, and your mark gets put from all of the different tools, and your mark gets put in order of a rank based upon that mark. Transparency, all applicants are treated equally on the basis of predetermined published criteria, and again, no quotas based on demographics. The Quebec First Nations and Inuit program, which is with the four schools, is supernumerary, and as you probably are aware, the distribution of seats is by a government decree. We have the external review. It's available on our website. We have a task force composed of these members who are looking at the recommendations of the external review. We will provide an interim report to the dean at the end of June, early July, as requested, and hopefully a final report in December. I think our work will likely be done by then. So our goal is to graduate the best doctors. Our priority is to continue getting better. Our vision is to select in a fair, transparent, and inclusive way. And indeed, your participation in the process is welcome. We're always looking for people to participate in the process. So thank you very much.
So we see backup slides. So I actually want to call the students up to take the podium. And do you have like a plan? There's no slides. So
There's no slides. So
that shows the superiority of our students. They can speak without slides.
All right. So hi, my name is Sophie. I was born here in Quebec. And as you can hear with my accent, I'm a francophone. Just to tell you a bit more about myself, I was born and raised here in Quebec, and I grew up in Saint-Adèle, for those who know where it is. Since now it has been really a formal speech, I'm more here to talk to you about my own experience during the admission process. So first of all, I want to tell you that I think the first encounter you really have with the university or the school you want to study in is during this admission process. So it really tells you a lot about the school that you're applying to. And for me, McGill, the admission process was really a revelation. It really told me, like, this is the school I want to be part of. And today, this is the school that, gratefully, I'm part of. So first of all, when we arrived, yeah, we were a little stressed. But then there was a really nice welcoming. Like, students were there. Students that wake up at, like, really in the morning. It was early because I think we started at like 7:30 in the morning, and they were there for us. They were waiting. Yeah, there was food, but there was also students. And seriously, they made every one of us feel really, really welcome, because they talked about their experience during the admission process, and they talked about McGill as a school. And you know what? They were all diverse, yes, but I felt like a part of me belonged in every one of them. And I really felt like we had a connection, and like today I can tell you this connection was McGill. So, okay, forget about the welcoming. Then they call your name. You're like super stressed. You get up. You're like, okay, I have to walk to my station. And then you get into the room. It's really a tiny room. But this room, it's impressive because there's only an actor. Which the actors are amazing, by the way. But there's an actor, and there's you, and there's nobody else. If I compare this experience with my experience in the other applications, because since I'm a francophone, I was lucky enough to get the interviews in the French universities, and they're very different process. When you get into the French school's MMIs, in the room, there's the actor, she's always there, there's you, and there's the people, the person evaluating you. And they're like sitting with their grade, and like they're looking at you, and you know, they look not really nice. So in that sense, it's really stressful. And for me, it's biased because you see that the person who is evaluating you, you see if it's a girl, if she's a girl, if he's a boy, you know, so it's, in my sense, it's less, it's more biased than at McGill where when you get into that room, there's only you, your performance, who you are, and the actor. And the person that are evaluating you, they're behind the doors. You don't hear them laugh. You don't hear them doing whatever they want to do. But you know that they're there, and it's really, for me, it was really anonymous, and in that sense, I knew that they were looking at me as who I was and who I am. Thirdly, my language. I did my McGill interviews in French because I'm more fluid in French, and I'm really grateful at McGill for allowing me to do my interview in French because, you know, the fact that I speak French and that I forget some S's and I don't pronounce my H very well in English, it still doesn't like tell them who I am and what I'm capable of. I feel like I'm here today not because of my language, but because I deserve to be here. And it's the same for all the students that are in here today. I feel like the fact that McGill removed that barrier it's a barrier because behind my language, I have my own qualities, and you know, excellence is everywhere. And I feel like if you remove these barriers like language and sex and religion and everything, that's the only way that you can get to that excellence. And I think that's what McGill is looking for. So in that sense, thank you, McGill, for allowing me to do my interviews in French. And finally, since I'm talking about French and English, anyways, there's a word in English that I learned this year. It's called physicianship. And I've tried, there's no French equivalence to physicianship. But I really love that word. Because for me, you know, physicianship, they say it's the holistic view of the physician. He's not only an academia, he's not only a doctor, but he's a human being, and he's able to interact with his patient. And for me, McGill is looking for a physician that like really represent this concept of physicianship. And this is why I chose McGill in the first place, because when I arrived at the interview at 7:30 in the morning, I felt welcome. I felt that they would look at me for who I was, and for what I was able to do and to bring to this community. And today, I'm really, really proud to be here today. I'm really grateful for McGill because I am McGill. And as every student here are, we're here because we deserve it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, everyone. So my name is Nebras Warsi. I was the Med 1 class president, as some of you may know, who wrote the sort of ill-fated letter to the Faculty of Medicine. I'm now lucky enough to be the MSS executive president for this coming year, so that's kind of cool. So a little bit of background about me. I was born in Saudi Arabia. I grew up in the UK. Then I went to Saskatchewan to do high school and, you know, check out some of the farming and all of that we have. And then I came to Quebec. I went to McGill for my undergrad, and now I'm here, luckily enough, for medicine. So a little bit more about me. I chose medicine because I have a strong desire to make a difference in my community, whichever community that is, whether it's around Canada, whether it's Saudi Arabia, whether it's the UK, anywhere in the world. And that's my passion. My desire is to use my critical thinking my scientific knowledge and my leadership ability to make a difference. And I felt that becoming a physician and through physicianship, that was the best way that I could fulfill that that desire. So in terms of the actual application process itself, I was fortunate enough to interview at a couple of different schools across Canada. And through my comparison between the application process, the interviews, the way that things are done at other schools, it really reaffirmed my desire to go to McGill, especially given the way that we have our process. So I know at a lot of schools, you know, for example, the Francophone schools look mostly at your GPA. At McGill, we look at the GPA, as you heard from Dr. Razek, 70%. There's also an emphasis on that personal letter. So all that motivation I just told you is not lost in the process. I felt that I was able to manifest that. I was able to show that through my application. I was able to show both who I am and what drives me to be a physician and why I believed I was competent enough to get in. And I guess, luckily enough, that was true. And so that's what I like a lot about McGill. As well, when you get to the process of the interview, as Sophie was saying, you see a different kind of interview at McGill from the other schools. And I mean that in the best possible way. Some schools will say, you know, tell me why you want to be a physician. Is that that's fairly easy, I think, to respond to when you've got a couple of months to prepare in advance. Whereas McGill, you go into a scenario. There's no evaluator. It's you and the actor, and you see exactly what you would be seeing as a physician. You see people who are upset. You see people who you need to counsel. You see people who you need to support. And you're able to bring out every aspect of your personality in order to do that. I believe that my classmates and I have seen that, you know, throughout this year. Every time we're working with a patient, it comes back. You see it again. You see, oh, that's what they were looking for. And it makes so much sense to us. Thank you to Charmaine and Dr. Razek for that process. And so that was really what drew me to McGill in the first place. I was really impressed with the way that we did our process, with the equity that is part of that process, and with the strong focus on excellence that is part of that process. So if I look back at my time during the admissions process, I can tell you that it was stressful, much more stressful than standing in front of a room and giving an address, probably the most stressful thing I've ever done. And, you know, I think that's completely understandable. I think that that's where a lot of the conversation we're having is coming from now. But when you see the number of applications and just what you're up against, it's ridiculous. But I think one thing that sort of came out of that is that I get to go to class every day. I get to look at my classmates and I get to be surprised every single day. You know, I'm sitting in that seat and I'm humbled, I'm blown away, and I don't even understand how, you know, I'm lucky enough to be a part of this group. My class, as you can see, many of my classmates are here today. We're wearing our I Am McGill name tag, so if you'd like to come hear about us, please come speak to us. But we have people who have taken on humanitarian endeavors, both at home and around the world. We have people who've really made a difference in their community and who I believe are going to make absolutely excellent physicians. So I recommend that if anyone has any misgivings, any questions, please come and speak to us. Come get to know our class and come get to know those people who are fortunate enough to be part of McGill Medicine. Thank you very much.
So my name is Aaron Silberman. I'm a second-year medical student, so I have a 1 year wiser, I guess. I'm from Montreal. I'm an Anglophone. I grew up here, so I guess I kind of represent that target audience that has been said to maybe be, you know, disadvantaged and less likely to get in than they used to be, for example. Like I said, I grew up here. I did my undergraduate degree here, got my degree in neuroscience, like Nebras. And I applied to McGill and a few other Ontario schools, mostly because I felt a connection to McGill. I felt a connection to the city because I'm from here. And secondarily, to be totally honest, I was slightly apprehensive to do medical school in my second language. That being said, if it didn't work out, I was more than open to applying to French medical schools to make that happen. The other reason I applied to McGill was because I know several people that have gone through the process before me, and from what I heard from them, which was both frustrating and refreshing, I guess, was that the question that always comes is, how do I get in? How do I prepare? And there's no answer. Like, that's what people told me, that's what I tell people, is that just be yourself and hope for the best. And that's a horrible answer, because you're just like, well, what do I do with that? But at the same time, it kind of like really aligned with my philosophy and the way I kind of live my life, that to kind of just, you know, be yourself and go about your day, do what you do best, and hopefully things will work out. And the fact that that's what they wanted to see, just for you to shine as a person, really, I don't know, it was refreshing to me. So I had to write a letter for my application, slightly different than it was now, so maybe slightly less relevant, but I found it a really good experience, I guess, because you get so caught up in the competitiveness of getting in. You know, you go through 3 years of undergrad, CEGEP, all with the goal of trying to get into medical school, and you're so hyper-focused on that it's so easy to lose focus of why you wanted to do this in the first place. And I'm sure all my colleagues can attest to this, that having to sit there and actually just type out 750 words, I think it was, I don't remember, about why you really want to do this was I think an important step, an important part of the process for me, because it allowed me to kind of set aside this competitiveness and really focus on it. And after a month of revisions, which the final draft looked nothing like the original, it was really a great process. Like they've alluded to with the interviews, the same kind of thing. I was so happy to get my interview to begin with that I kept trying to think of ways to prepare, and there was no way, which again was frustrating. But once I started the interview, like, you totally forget that you're in an interview. Like, I had so much fun in each station. I see my colleagues nodding their heads because it's so true. That, like, then at the end of the scenario, they say, end of scenario, exit room, please. You're like, whoa, it's a scenario. But it was nice. It was really nice to see. Like I've kept saying that they, you know, that there's no cookie cutter mold that they're looking for. That you can try to fit yourself into a box. That, you know, be who you are, and that, you know, hopefully that they'll see your strengths and your excellences and the traits that you bring to the table, and they can see that, you know, with all those things and with all the diversity that we all bring, that, you know, we can become the best possible doctors that we can. And if I can just say, I guess, a few words on my experience in the last 2 years about my class, I can't imagine being more impressed, like, by my class in the last 2 years. They're really awesome. I mean, they're really like, nice, compassionate, intelligent, diverse set of people. I have friends, good friends, that are med Ps, undergrads, that are older than me, that have their own children, that are from various countries. It's less common in our class. And really, I think it's what makes us really special, that there's no surprises. We all bring something different to the table, and we've all really come together as a family, and we really help each other through this process. And that's got to be, I mean, no other way, when you start with 2,800 people, it's got to be some sort of, something's going right, in my mind. So yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We've heard from a variety of people, ranging from the head of the school, Dr. Primavesi, to the person who's responsible for the admissions process, and we've shown off some students. Is everything okay? Oh, you're going to sit on they have to sit on the small chairs. Okay. They've been bad, so they have to sit on the small chairs. But now I'd like to give over to the room to ask questions. I get to moderate. A couple of rules of engagement. I know there's some members of the press here. You're welcome, but I'd ask you to save your questions to the end. I'd also remind you that the purpose of this is to discuss the process. We try and avoid any personalized comments directed about individuals. Other than that, everything's fair game. Who goes first? Gary goes first.
That was a very
helpful... wait, can we just bring you a mic there, Gary, so people can hear?
Salim!
Yeah!
Concreteness of it, and I appreciated your wanting to focus on nuts and bolts. I wonder if you might go a step further on the transparency. Certainly the better American schools, and others as well, have shared at the outset for situating students some other demographics of the classes they've accepted in recent years, and typically that involves median and minimum scores on MCATs. We, of course, don't have those anymore, but I wonder whether you could share with us For the university component of our class, the median, that is the middle typical GPA of a student accepted into McGill.
Do we have that slide, Celine?
We do have that slide, actually. It's not the median, it's the mean.
Median's a better measure, but I'll accept the mean.
Well, I think we have the mode also.
Right? We may have the mode as well, but hang on.
Modes are hokey.
Boy, there's lots of slides.
Which slide is it?
We have it?
No, that's the applicant.
We don't have it on this slide deck. Do you have this slide somewhere?
No.
So I can tell you, I only remember one number. The mode is 4.0.
Yeah.
Okay, the mode, because that's a very striking number. So the average is 3.84, but the mode, the most common number, if you have to pick which number is the most frequent, it's 4.0. I don't remember the median off the... Charmaine has the numbers. Okay, well...
But do I have my glasses?
Yeah. So while Salim looks for his glasses, where the heck is this number?
It's a pink.
A pink. So the... Okay, so this is the average here, 3.78? For Quebec students.
Quebec students.
Right, but where is the mode stuff?
Charmaine, come and read it.
That's okay.
Anyway, we'll send it to you. But the point is that the thing is skewed to higher marks, which is what you're getting at. Okay, so it's like the average is 3.78, but it's not like it's 3.78 because there's five people who have four and everybody else has 3.2. It's the opposite. The most common score is four.
Yeah.
Okay. In fact, the goal of this, I know I'm answering for Salim, but just to be clear, the goal of this is to have diversity, so it's not just the people with four.
Yeah. All right.
You better talk.
I can tell you some more. I mean, the average is for the last few years, in terms of mean, has been above 3.8 for Quebec applicants, and for out-of-province Canadians, it's in the 3.9s and has been progressively rising over the years that I, for instance, handled the process.
Right, and that means, as one could infer, that the median, if mode is 4 and the mean is 3.78, means the median is somewhere in the high 3.8, probably.
Correct.
Yes, correct.
But we have to get the right number, but yes.
Correct.
There's a question over here. You better stand up.
Oh, sure. My name is Pedram. I'm a second-year medical student.
Is it for me?
Sorry?
Is it for me? Or?
Yeah, it's more for Dr. Razek.
Yeah.
I definitely wasn't one of those 4.0 students, but that's a separate story. I was just wondering, you said for the academic and non-academic ratings, there was two raters. I was just wondering, did the two rate independently of each other, and if one of the raters that you had was like systemically biased, for example, was always giving lower scores to students. Would you correct for that? Those are my two questions.
Okay, so that's actually a bunch of really, really good questions. We use for raters, okay, in terms of raters may have maybe hawks or doves, right? You know, they may be easy evaluators or not so easy. For a hard evaluator, sort of think of Dr. Cummings. We had a whole conversation this morning about that, and easy evaluator, think of me. What we use is we use something called Z scoring, okay, which means that every rater acts as his or her own control, and they do a large population of they do approximately around 100, between 75 and 100 files, so that the population is large for us to do that. It is actually the sort of, I would say, like the industry standard. It's what most of our colleagues are doing across the country to handle that. And your other question was about the different raters, right? So the different raters do rate independently. This year, different than when you applied, this year the CV and the personal narrative were put together, okay? And each rater did that each. Okay? And we do, on a psychometric and populational basis, we look at the correlations between raters as a part of having control, quality control. And we observe moderate correlations between raters, which for us justifies a couple of things. It says that we're moving in the right direction. And it also says that it's good to have two raters rather than one rater, because if they were strongly correlated, we could sort of say, well, why do you have two raters? Okay.
I think there's a question here, Dr. Slapkoff.
Thanks very much. And once we're introducing ourselves, I'm Barry Slapkoff. I want to thank Dr. Eidelman and Dr. Razak Pirvesi for organizing this. I think it's really important that we have this town hall, and thank you for the students. Before I ask my question, I just want to make one tiny little editorial comment about the students' presentations. They were wonderful, all of you, thank you. And for Sophie in particular, I loved your presentation. I love the fact that you talked about physicianship. I've personally devoted a large part of my career to promoting that ideal, and I love the fact that you brought it up. And I love the fact that you brought up the French-English issue in 2007 when a decision was made to make a proposal to remove the MCAT. I was part of that three-doctor group that made that proposal. I think it was the right thing to do, and I think we at McGill here should be the model for the rest of Quebec in how we treat the other language. I think we shouldn't be talking about how the other schools do it differently. We should be talking about how we do it right in terms of the French English issue, and I thank you for bringing it up, which brings me to my comments. So I've probably given as much thought to the admissions process as anybody else in the room, so I'm going to make my comments, I would suggest that McGill stops being the only faculty of medicine. This is for you, Dr. Razak. I would suggest that McGill stops being the only faculty of medicine, or faculty of anything else for that matter in North America, that is an office of admissions, equity, and diversity. And I would suggest that we develop two offices, one for admissions and one to promote the ideals of diversity. Every year we reject 2,000 applicants from our Office of Admissions, Equity, and Diversity. And that can lead many refused candidates and their families to the obvious conclusion that they may have been rejected because they were not the right type of diverse. Can you please comment on whether or not you believe that moving forward we should continue to support diversity, to support diversity issues by having a distinct office of diversity and separate the issues of diversity from the issues of admissions? Okay, thank you.
For me or for...
Who's that for?
Is that for?
I guess it could be either for you, Dr. Eidelman, or you, Dr. Razak.
I mean, I can...
Well, let me handle it, because it's a structure. No, I mean, it's a fact that we certainly discussed that, and I think that we probably will move in that direction. We've heard that, we've gotten that feedback. You know, in the external review, we got a recommendation not to do that. I know the students like the fact that it's together. At least that's what they told the external review. But it's clear from a lot of feedback I've gotten, not just from you, but from many people, that it leads to confusion. The other reason why I've been thinking about it that has nothing to do with what you said has to do with the fact that it doesn't only apply to medical school. Right now, it's linked to the admissions office, essentially, of the medical school. But we, as you know, have multiple schools here. And we have many learners here and many professors who are also equally valued members of the Faculty of Medicine. And so in our own way, in order to be equitable, we need to look at that. I also would like to, but this is part of a deeper reflection that I think we have to do. I think that decision to put it together was made rather hastily a number of years ago. I'd like to make the next version done in a more thoughtful way. But certainly we're very open to that suggestion.
I just want to point out that the point is heard, and it's actually been a part of the discussion at the external review task force. I guess notwithstanding, I hope I've been able to show that the processes are actually separate, right? Like the process of recruitment and pipelines is actually a separate part of the office, but moving forward, definitely we this is part of the discussion at the external review task force.
Okay, there's some questions, Diana. There's some questions up there. Has anybody got a mic on this side? Foss doesn't have a mic, or
Ooh, Sam.
I think if we had standing mics, if people lined up easier. Anyway. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks very much. My name's Sam Shemi. I'm, in fact, a colleague of Salim's in the ICU at the Montreal Children's Hospital. I found this session extremely informative for somebody who knows very little about the process, and I appreciate the striving towards the fairest decision-making possible for medical school applicants. But I do have a question, and what I'm trying to understand is, while McGill should be applauded for these efforts, if in fact that McGill is more flexible, more equitable, and more diverse than before, and perhaps more equitable and diverse than other medical schools in Quebec, if they are not as equitable and diverse, doesn't that in fact disadvantage some of the community that we serve currently? That if, for instance, if Anglophone Montrealers don't have the same equitable access to other medical schools in Quebec, for instance, doing an interview in English, doesn't that in fact disadvantage that group?
So I think, so first of all, the other schools, and you know, that's something that's to be taken up with the other schools, really, in terms of how they operate or interview. With respect to Anglophones, I can give you the following data that that will hopefully help you understand a little bit. So McGill has 20.9% of the medical school positions in the province that are assigned to the four schools. Okay, if we look at the proportion of Anglophones described in the province by various I can think of two, one of which is the 2006 census, and there's one other that's failing me right now what the actual reference is. But you get a number that is somewhere between 7.7 and 8.4% of the population of the province. So if we were to be the school that is for Anglophone students, for instance, I don't think that we are exclusively the school that does that, but if we were to do that, we would sort of need to... Our medical school population would need to have somewhere around 37% of its class be described as Anglophone. If you do 7.7 over 20.9, which does it. And, you know, we really see that number, actually number higher than that, in all of the surveys that I have, the diversity surveys that we have administered to entering students. So I think the point is that Anglophones are doing well in the process, and they are accessing the spots in proportion or even perhaps greater proportion to the population share. So hopefully that assuages that comment a little bit, but it's taken to heart.
Other comments or questions? Right beside you.
Please
there.
Go ahead.
Hello, my name is Harrison. I'm a first-year medical student, and my question is directed to Dr. Razak. I noticed that you mentioned we were discussing a lot of things about GPAs and how this guy's GPA is 4. We're trying to avoid that and going back down and looking at the person as a whole. Now, in terms of the actual GPA as a score, it is a measurement that varies amongst departments that are actually applying. Someone in psychology, I've actually worked on an departmental appraisal committee before, where you actually see the grade distribution based on what program you're in. And someone in psychology might have a generally higher GPA than someone in chemistry. And there's a lot of people applying where a GPA of 4 or 4.33, if you're at Concordia, is impossible just because of the grading scheme. I was wondering if you could elaborate on the system that you normalize it so everyone's put on the same level.
So we do not normalize for, we do not keep data on different schools because it would not be fair, actually. We do not know how every single program performs. So as a corrected GPA is a corrected GPA. The one thing that is a little bit like that is the Cote de Rendement Collégial, the COTER, which is calculated by the Ministry of Education and does have...
Just to remind people, that's the R-score at CGIP, right?
Yeah, the R-score, the COTER or the R-score. After 25 years here, I'm very bilingual. But That one is a ministry calculation, and it's aided in being able to be done because students in CJEP are relatively undifferentiated. They all are taking, if they want to get into medicine, they're all taking Sciences de la Santé, and it's the same courses that they're taking. So there the government does have a part of it, and I actually don't have the way to calculate it. The government calculates it for looking at the strength of the pool that they're in terms of how grades are calculated.
Thank you.
This side of the room. Okay. Earl? Oh, we're going in the back? Sorry. Oh. Sorry, Earl. I tried.
There's one here.
Oh, there's one down here? Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, there's, yeah.
Okay, well, we'll get you next.
Okay, we have one here.
If we bring a mic down.
Right here?
Dr. Yes, go Richard. Ahead. And
bring. Okay.
I'm a basic scientist and a former chair, and I'm interested in the students, of course. And my question is to any of the students. And on one of the slides, it was a very important word for me, and that was scholarship. So I'm interested in any of the students' understanding of what is meant by this word and what's their responsibility to scholarship.
Brass, you want to take that?
Sure.
You have to send Dr. Bergeron your famous letter.
So let me put it in context
for
you. Mm-hmm. In 1985 or so, and there are experts in this room that will correct me, there were about 45,000 deaths from cancer in Canada. And if you plot it, it goes up each and every year. And in 2013, there's 75,000. And there's been no impact whatsoever on cancer deaths. So what is your understanding of scholarship and what the medical student feels about it?
Just so you feel better, the rest of the professors in the second row here, including several chairs, are all looking freaked out. So go ahead.
So just to clarify, would you like me to respond to the changing number of cancer deaths? I'm just wondering.
Okay. Should medical students be thinking about scholarship?
So what medical students should be thinking about scholarship? So I think that this is something that's actually kind of built into the new curriculum with our Research One component. Scholarship, for me personally, is a very, very important thing. I did my bachelor's in neuroscience. I completed a number of scholarly research projects, and those were things that drove me to become a physician. So part of what made me want to go into medical school on a personal level, before I comment on the class in general, was the ability to create new knowledge. So just as you said, seeing a problem in the clinic. I used to work on MS research. So seeing a problem in the clinic, working with these patients is one aspect of being a physician. At the same time, one as a physician gains a very, very sort of unique perspective in terms of working with people with these sorts of diseases. I mean, MS has a lot of management, but it can't be cured. So you get that perspective. You see the patients, you see what the need of the patients are, and you're able to work through scholarly research to improve that, whether that's sort of a clinical project or that's a basic science project. I think that that's a very, very important facet of being a physician. And so part of the thing that I support in the new curriculum is the fact that each and every one of us needs to do, in fact, a scholarly research project. Whether that's in the clinical domain, the basic science domain, or the social studies of medicine domain is up to us. But I think that's it. You know, from the beginning, we're sort of instilled with the idea that basic science in medicine is important. Clinical knowledge in medicine is important. And, the aspect of being a scholar is just as important as every other aspect of being a healthcare professional. So I think that those are my views on that.
Thank you, DeBras. Is that okay, John? Well, there you go. Okay, over here.
My name is Debbie Friedman. I'm trauma director at the Children's Hospital, and
I've been
involved in the admissions process, and have particularly enjoyed being involved with the CV stations, where I really got a chance to meet the students and really put them all together in a nice package. My comments, and I have two of them, are related to the heavily weighted use of CJEP marks in the undergraduate applicant group. At McGill at the present time, it appears that it is unlikely that students who have completed a university-level degree and received average marks in CJEP can ever get into medicine. This seems to be true even if they have completed a rigorous undergraduate honors science degree and obtained a 4.0 GPA. This is because it is only science prerequisites that are used to evaluate students at the MMI stage of the interview process for 20 presents, as you mentioned, Salim, and the vast majority of students we know take these prerequisite courses at CEGEP. In my opinion, the mark that a 17-year-old gets in their first or second semester of CEGEP should not have any influence on whether or not they can ever be a medical student at McGill. Can you please comment on the use of CEGEP science marks in the evaluation of applicants with university-level science degrees? Because I know that having been involved, there were other criteria that used to be used in the past.
Okay. So I think this is actually, thank you for the question. It's really important to clarify. So there's a phase one, which is the screening, and then there's the phase two, which is the MMI and the science prerequisites. So to be invited to an interview, if you're an undergraduate applicant, who not an MD, MedP applicant, your CEGEP marks will not figure in to being invited to the interview. We only use university-level courses for that. So this, so this 70% academic dossier does not include CEGEP marks at all, okay? In Quebec, so here, what you see is you see this 20% basic science performance score. This is what I think you're talking about. So this would show up in the part after you've been invited to interview. And in Quebec, for those of you that may or may not be familiar, most students will obtain the prerequisite courses for medicine in CEGEP. Okay? That doesn't actually preclude them from also taking them in during their university studies. For instance, some students may choose to upgrade their marks, or they're studying something else, a different course in CEGEP that didn't allow them to get the prerequisites, so they may have to take them in university studies. So this is where that basic science performance would show up. It would show up in the part here where it's 20% and 80% multiple mini interviews. I think that there's nothing that stops a student from upgrading their prerequisite courses in their university degree program. And for those of you that wonder where that's coming from, that is, our history is to have had an MCAT, right? So when we stopped the MCAT in 2010, we wanted to keep some way of making sure that we are admitting students with good performance in the science courses, and this is how we sort of kept the basic science performance score. And actually, you'll see that plus MCAT where applicable, a student that wishes to submit MCAT scores can have MCAT scores count for at least half of that. So that's actually another way that they could improve that performance.
But what does that say about our rigorous science programs that these students are going through and the credibility behind that to stand on their own merit? Because let's face it, every 17-year-old doesn't know exactly what they're doing and shouldn't have it held against them for the rest of their life, because I suppose if we look around and some of the people in this room, probably some of those people fell in the category as well and are excellent physicians today.
The person could take prerequisite courses during their university studies. We actually accept prerequisite courses taken outside of a degree program, so that they can be upgraded and taken again.
So I guess my last question is, moving forward, what are you going to do to warn the high school students that from the second they step into CEGEP, they need to be aware of this and they should be cognizant of it in every decision they make about doing extracurricular activities and everything else, because this is what it's going to boil down to?
We have it on our website, but we'll make sure we have regular communications with the counselors and so on. We'll make sure that they know about that.
Okay, it's Earl's turn.
Can I just add a comment?
Oh, yes, of course. Sorry, Rob.
And this comes to alignment of admissions with the medical school curriculum. So the MMIs measure a lot of physicianship properties, but the first 18 months of medical school is still quite heavily based in the basic science. And I know that for meeting students who have difficulty in the program, they often come from backgrounds that are less based in the sciences, or who have had the basic sciences further away. So what ends up happening, students have to relearn the basic sciences as well as learning what's in the curriculum, which is an enormous amount of things to do. So we have to have some assurances in terms of alignment that students are able have learned. It has to be some measure to make sure that the students have a prerequisites that they for success within the basic science part of the curriculum.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to move on because we have a lot of hands, and I want to give as many people as possible a chance. Oh no, I think Earl is next. I promised Earl. You can be.
Thank you, David. So my question relates to what you've been. I don't. Anybody can answer it.
Okay.
In terms of the MCATs, so clearly going from 900 applicants to 2,800. I'm assuming a big part of that has to do with the getting rid of the MCATs and opening the door to people who would not normally write the MCATs. And so my question from that relates a lot to a lot of your answers to the previous questions in terms of it's a good evaluation process to put people onto the same playing field. So part of the question is why did we get rid of the MCATs? The second is that if you have 2,800 applicants and there's 3,100 at U of T where MCATs are a prerequisite, clearly that's just opening the doors for more of the Francophone population in the province, not when you talk about 7% of Anglophones in the province, it's 20-something to 30% on the island of Montreal. Don't we have a responsibility to the Anglophone Montreal community in terms of allowing them equal access, because clearly at the French universities to get 86% in French, I certainly wouldn't pass that now, and I think I'm a decent physician. And so it closes the doors to a lot of people. And do we have a responsibility globally?
I think you may answer as well, but the thing that I told you, that I told Sam, was actually the spots in the whole province. So it's reasonable to compare the percentage of Anglophones in the whole province for that. With respect to the MCAT and functioning as barrier, there's really a lot. So to write the MCAT is, I believe, around $1,600 or something like that. And the course is $1,600 and then $900 to write it. And the outgoing president of the Canadian Federation of Medical Students, Jesse Cancer, his name is Cancer, K-A-N-C-I-R, they did a little study at U of T and looked at indirect costs as well, he's from U of T, people not working in the summer, taking the summer off and all those kinds of things. And it's around 8,000 or 9,000, at least what I heard from just speaking with him recently at the CCME. So I think we really have to think about that very closely. And we now have a 4-year experience without the MCAT. And
you forgot about us MedPs.
Oh, right. That's the other thing.
Forget about us.
Our dean is a MedP. The MedPs have never had to write the MCAT, right? Ever since that program for the stuff in the paper last August, we were able to go back into the archives, and we think the program started in 1973, but we're not 100% sure. But that program has been operational since the 1970s, at least. So we have a good experience.
The brass wants to add a word.
Mm-hmm. Super quick 1-minute thing. I'm glad that the example of the University of Toronto was brought up because I was, able to apply to other Canadian medical schools. And I mean, they don't, put that much emphasis on the MCAT. In order to actually get into the U of T, you need a 9 in each section of the MCAT, which is a 50th percentile in each of the sections. After that, the MCAT is no longer looked at. So that's my first point. Secondly, from my perspective, I know there's a lot of Anglophone, Francophone perspective, and I do understand that there are some quotas in other out-of-province schools, but as an Anglophone, I'm actually privileged enough, resident of Quebec, but I was able to apply to 14 Anglophone medical schools in the country, whereas there are 3 Francophone schools. And I believe 3 or 4 of them don't have any provincial quotas. Chiefly among them, the University of Toronto has no quota based on where you're from. So, I mean, I think that we are actually at an advantage and not a disadvantage, but that's my opinion. Thank you.
So I want to just finish up by saying that the primary responsibility of this university is to have excellence. OK, Okay, in the medical school, it's to produce excellent physicians. In order to do that, we have to have a competitive applicant pool. We now have a competitive applicant pool. A few years ago, we had a less competitive applicant pool. Now, I'm sure that we produce fine physicians then, too. But the better the applicant pool, the better our graduates are. And I can tell you that our graduates are amazing. I know you heard that from the students, but it's certainly the case from the point of view of the faculty. When I meet them, we have extraordinary people, which means since most of the graduates of the school will remain in Quebec, despite what you read in the paper, that means that we're preparing the next generation of caregivers for those of us who are going to need them in the future, which is somewhat reassuring. There's a question up there that I rudely interrupted before.
Yep, the straight. Exactly. I'm sorry. My name is Michael Mackey. I'm from physiology. Could somebody in a one-line sentence just tell me exactly why the MCAT requirement was terminated at McGill? Was it money?
I think I'll give you one line. I'll try, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, okay, Yasleen? The one line was it was serving as an impediment to having an adequately sized applicant pool. Through money, language, et cetera.
So it had nothing to do with excellence.
No, with all due respect to the non-med P's, we already had 40% of the class get in without an MCAT for, we've done this now for decades, and at the risk of being somewhat presumptuous, some of us have turned out okay without the MCAT. So we had evidence that the MCAT was not a sufficiently powerful discriminator to make a difference to the class quality, but it was serving nonetheless as an impediment to some people to apply. So we were diminishing our applicant pool without getting any benefit. Okay, so the rationale behind getting rid of the MCAT is it wasn't doing its job, but it was preventing us from having the best quality applicants. Okay, we've got to get some people on this side because we've been hanging out on that side. Mark Roper is there. I can see him there.
Yeah, Mark Roper, head of primary care at the MUHC. And I must say I've had the pleasure of teaching first-year medical students this year and the last couple of years, and it's been an excellent experience. Diversity and equity, what measures do you use to... you must have 10 or 12 measures you use, and the Accreditation Council of Canada uses. Could you define what measures you use for both equity and diversity in your class?
Okay, so I think the first point to make is that they're not used at all. No measures are used of equity and diversity in the actual selection process. Okay, so that's an important point to come out. We have the Widening Participation Committee, which is chaired by Dr. J. Marie Ferdinand, who I do not see in the audience here. She probably couldn't make it. Whose